Grüezi miteinander, ganz herzlich willkommen und einen wunderschönen guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, liebe Freunde aus nah und fern. Ich begrüße Sie zu dieser Sondersendung von Weltwoche Daily, die andere Sicht, unabhängig, kritisch, gut gelaunt und heute mit einem Spezialgast, der uns zugeschaltet ist aus den Vereinigten Staaten von Amerika. Es ist Professor Jeffrey Sachs, bei uns hier schon mehrmals im Programm und auch unseren Lesern bestens bekannt. Jeffrey Sachs, ein Ökonom, ein früherer Professor an der Columbia University und auch ein aktiver Teilnehmer am internationalen Geschehen. Ich freue mich sehr, dass er da ist und ich werde nun auf Englisch wechseln. Professor Sachs, dear Jeffrey, great to have you here. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
My first question, you had a great speech. It was really a milestone speech at the European Parliament concerning the Ukraine war and your personal experience in how it came all about. What was the response? What struck you? What were your observations regarding the reactions you got to your fantastic speech?
In the room, the reactions were very good. Of course, that's what we call sample selection bias. Who wanted to come hear me probably had some idea of what I was going to say. But the speech has resonated very widely around Europe. I've had a lot of positive reactions. Basically, I told the story of how the US and its unipolar idea was the root cause of so many of the problems we have today, including the Ukraine war itself. And I also called on Europe to create a real foreign policy, not based on war, based on Europe's interests and its security, but not with the warmongering that was originally provoked by the United States, but now, even as Trump tries to find an exit ramp from this war, many European politicians continue the warmongering, which is really disappointing, although I think it will change.
It's interesting. I mean, we had this meeting yesterday in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia, unfortunately not in Switzerland. We don't want to go into this now, but we had this agreement, the ceasefire. The Americans are delivering weapons. What do you think about these talks? Is your perspective on that?
Ceasefire is not the point, actually. The point is peace. The question is what else was discussed rather than what they have told us on the surface. If what came out of this is a 30-day ceasefire, but nothing more, it's not going to happen, actually. I think the Russians have said repeatedly there are root causes of this conflict. They need to be addressed in a serious way. I agree with that. This is the need for real diplomacy. A 30-day ceasefire means an invitation for starting again the war. What we need to know, and I don't know at this moment because it's one day after Riyadh, what else was discussed? Did the Ukrainians say, yes, neutrality, territorial concessions, because that's going to be part of any peace. What was really said? Presumably something more was said than a 30-day ceasefire. Perhaps what more was said is being communicated with the Russians by the Americans right now. So perhaps there was more progress than we know of. But as usual, maybe understandably, but in any event, as usual, we don't really understand to this moment what happened. All I can say clearly is if this is 30-day ceasefire without any more substantive agreement on the way to end the conflict, I don't think there will be a ceasefire.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, Trump has made some remarks which could indicate that he shares your view on the root causes of this war. He said on several occasions, well, there are many people are guilty there, and I can understand that the Russians did not like the NATO expansion. What do you think? Do the Americans, does this government have a real perception of this war? Do they see clearly what is at stake? And is there hope for a thorough solution in a way that you have just indicated?
In this administration, there's a very high noise to signal ratio. Every day, contradictory statements are made about everything, whether it's tariffs on or off, whether it's about ending the war versus sanctioning Russia, whether it's about President Xi being best friends versus China being a perfidious country. It's a very high noise to signal ratio. Some people say it's a method. Some people say it's a confusion. Some people say it's a difference of views. To tell you the truth, I don't know what the reason is. I don't like this kind of governance of so much noise. I don't think the stock markets like it either. By the way, this is one of the conclusions. It's just a tremendous amount of uncertainty. Given that, it is not easy to say what's at the core of all of this. When it comes to Ukraine, I think there's enough material now, enough statements made by the president, made by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, made by the National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, that suggests that the U.S. isn't going to invest in this war longer. They may prevaricate, they may threaten sanctions, they may do all sorts of things, but I personally find it pretty much unimaginable, for example, that Trump would go back to Congress and say, vote more money so we could send more arms. That, to my mind, is now beyond the politics. I may be wrong, but if that's the case, with all the noise, it's probably the case that this war is coming to an end. The reason it's coming to an end is without the US support, Ukraine cannot fight on, period. And the idea that European politicians profess that, well, even if the United States stops, we will take on, this is ridiculous. It's not going to happen.
I mean,
So, in this sense, I think the war is coming to an end. But I want to emphasize again, there's a lot of noise in this.
the deepest root cause of this war, it seems to me, is this great, if you want to call it, misunderstanding of the West towards Russia. I mean, after the victory in the Cold War, the Americans, the Europeans, they thought they shouldn't take seriously the Russian concerns anymore. They could expand more and more. They did things they would never expect, never accept in their own sphere of influence. So they didn't take the Russians seriously. And the Russians felt really threatened by this strategic expansion. And now the question is, has the American policy towards Russia really changed? Do you see the honest conviction on the side of this government, which praises itself as a total alternative to what we have seen before? Do you see the honest conviction that President Trump is really willing to find a solution to repair the broken relationship between the United States on the and the Russian Federation?
I think the way you put it is absolutely right, but I'd put it in even broader terms. The United States leadership thinks a lot of itself and thinks a lot of the United States. This has been true even before the end of the Soviet Union in 1991. The U.S. has always viewed itself as an exceptional country, meaning that it has an exceptional role in the world. When one of our secretaries of state wrote the history of the early post-World War II period, Dean Acheson entitled his book "Present at the Creation." That's actually to my mind says a lot. That's the American view. During the Cold War period, clearly there was a bipolarity in the world because the Soviet Union was a very powerful country. when the Soviet Union ended by dissolving into its 15 separate states, the US arrogance went into overdrive. The US said, this is a unipolar world. We're the sole superpower. We're the indispensable country. One quotation after another about how absolutely remarkable the United States is and how the US leads the world and how the US creates the rules-based order, never defining what the rules are, because the rules-based order means whatever rule the United States says the rule is. So this arrogance is astounding. It misses a basic point that the US is 4.1% of the world population, and the other 95.9% of the world population is not thrilled to be led by 4.1% of the world population. And so the unreality of all of this has been true from the beginning. But now, with the spread of technology, with China's rise, with Russia's renewed power and technological capacity, we are truly, undeniably in a multipolar world. So the real question is, what is the U.S. security state view of that new reality? Well, our Secretary of State actually said, yes, we are in a multipolar world. Believe me, that is an intellectual breakthrough for the United States of America government, even to utter that sentence, because Biden, to the end, lived in a dream world of the 1990s, the indispensable state, the leader of the free world, whatever high rhetoric one could imagine. At least that is diminished. The question is, what does it mean? Well, we're in very early days of this in a very noisy administration and a very, I think, confused one in many ways. No doubt the U.S. government, no doubt President Trump still greatly overestimates American power, by the way. Trump thinks, I close the U.S. market and the rest of the world is terrified. If they don't have access to the U.S. market, the world economy will collapse. No, Mr. President, the rest of the world will go on pretty much just fine, is actually the truth of it. But the Americans don't know that. Just like they thought, we're going to sanction Russia economically and bring the Russian economy to its knees. I tried to tell them, and no, that also is not going to happen, but they didn't listen. So there still is a lot of arrogance in the U.S. Maybe the arrogance is, well, there are three big powers right now, the US, Russia, and China. We ought to avoid each other's lanes so we don't have head-on collisions. That may be the view. Trump certainly still speaks a big imperialist line, but against small, weak countries. So he wants to take over Panama or take over the Panama Canal. He wants to own Greenland. He wants to make Canada, the 51st state. Canada's not so weak in that sense, but still, he's a bully in a lot of different areas. So this is not sweet talk. This is not, let's sit down and work out a new global arrangement. There still is a lot of bullying, but maybe less bullying vis-a-vis Russia and possibly vis-a-vis China. There's a lot of bullying still in the Middle East. We own Gaza. We own it's Gaza Riviera. This nonsense talk is not good. It's not even remotely, in my view, tactically good from a deal-making point of view. It's just noise, 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 noise. And so the answer to the question is we're in an unstable period.
It's not clear to say whether it's enlightened bullying or just noisy bullying. Let's talk about the Russian president, Vladimir Putin. And the question is, how strong? Donald Trump likes to use the metaphor of cards. How strong are the cards? Zelensky has no strong cards. How strong are the cards of President Trump vis-à-vis President Putin? I mean, can he now just put pressure and say, well, you know, we're sanctioning you, and there is a rather tough timeline, it seems to be, which is not a good idea in diplomatic relay in diplomatic talks, to say, okay, you have to immediately come to the negotiating table. How strong is the American position, is Trump's position towards Putin at the moment? Can he force him to come to the negotiating table and accept this kind of a deal, which we see now emerging?
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's a cliche, but I think actually, as I've thought about it in recent days, a reasonable cliche that the US plays cards, basically poker, Russia plays chess, and China plays Go. So it's a kind of cliche, but when you think about it, what does it mean? Poker is a very interesting game. Partly it depends on what you're staring at when you're looking at your cards, and partly it's about bluffing. The Americans are full of bluffing. We got a great hand. We'll raise you. We'll bet the pot and so forth. I don't know if I can say it, but there's a lot of bullshit in it. From a poker point of view, chess is not like that. Chess, you're staring at the board, both sides. There's not bluffing. There are complex both tactics and strategy. It can be long, complicated games. Some play the end game, some play the middle game, and so forth. Go, which I don't play, I think is in a way even more variations and a slower game, indeed. So the US plays cards, it plays poker, and Trump talks in that imagery. Putin does not say what cards anyone has because they're not playing cards. Sometimes it's said, by the way, that Europe plays bridge, which I think could be right
Probably an
also.
overestimation. I'm not sure whether that they know which game they're actually playing, if they're playing a game.
That may be true as well. So does the US have the cards? No. There still is a lot of bluff. There's a lot of bluster. The Russians are pretty methodical, and Putin's pretty careful, and they're pretty much going step by step. So the fact of the matter is, when Biden was full in, and everybody was revved up for war and maximum sanctions and will defeat Russia, Russia was not defeated. Trump has basically said, we're not out to defeat Russia. So, what are the cards? The cards are not that Russia can be pushed into a corner. What I do think is true is that there's a benefit from peace. But that means that not a 30-day ceasefire. That means defining what is a peace agreement. And here, I think it's pretty damn obvious, I have to tell you. Because a peace agreement was essentially reached on April 15th, 2022. It was about to be signed. It defined that there were a few key issues. The most important was permanent neutrality of Ukraine. The second was territorial rearrangements. And the third was security guarantees. That's what's in the April 15, 2022 draft peace agreement. The United States and UK stopped that agreement because the idea was Ukraine should fight on, Russia should be weakened, America was going to raise the stakes. This is the poker game. We're going to bring in HIMARS and ATACMS. We're going to toughen the sanctions. We're going to call Putin and raise the stakes. And it failed. About 1 million Ukrainians have been killed or seriously wounded since that time, and the situation is worse on the battlefield. And I think Trump has to know that, does know that, doesn't want to play Biden's losing hand. So no, I don't think that there are ways to force Russia into a 30-day ceasefire, for example. But there are ways to reach a peace. And the peace involves permanent neutrality, stopping this NATO enlargement, which is a fundamental cause of all of this, understanding that certain territories are not going back. Ukraine's not getting back its 1991 border. And again, whatever anyone thinks about that, Ukraine didn't have to lose an inch had it played its cards, if I could put it that way, differently from 2014 onward. Security arrangements, we actually have a UN Security Council to make security arrangements, and that's the right place for that. So a deal could be reached that's in Russia's interest, that's in Ukraine's interest, that's in America's interest, that's in the world's interest, that's in Europe's interest. It could be reached pretty quickly. We still don't talk about that substance. Europe doesn't even talk about what it means when it says as long as it takes. If ever there was a BS phrase, that's it. What does it mean? Takes for what? The Europeans never explained it. The whole thing is to dumb down the discussion by using PR slogans like you would have a slogan for some brand, just do it or something like that. Do what? This is not a branding exercise. This is not a poker game. This is our world. And that needs a much more careful definition. And we don't have that to this moment.
Is President Zelensky finished, or will he somehow survive this political situation, which goes in a direction he probably did not want? What do you think?
You know, I don't know what's going to happen to an individual, but this line of approach of Ukraine is completely finished. The idea that we're fighting to our 1991 borders, we're fighting for the Ukraine peace plan, we have the United States, we have the Western alliance. This was all a bunch of bluster and very sad, very naive that Ukraine by decree will not negotiate with the Russians until they leave all Ukrainian territory. Again, it's pathetic, actually. It's sad. I tried to say this many times to the Ukrainians. They then said, no, no, you're an enemy. You're a Putin apologist and so forth. I said, no, no, I'm trying to help save you, Ukraine, because what's going to happen, I kept telling them, is you will become the Afghanistan of Europe. And I'm sorry to say that my warnings were correct. And now the United States is doing what it did in Afghanistan. It made a complete disastrous mess and then left. And it's going to do the same thing. So I don't want to blame the Ukrainians, except that they listened to the United States. And for God's sake, don't listen that way, or listen, but don't believe every word that you hear. Kissinger told everybody very clearly decades ago to be a friend of, to be an enemy of the United States is dangerous. To be a friend of the United States is fatal. People should understand what Kissinger was talking about.
What do you think about President Putin and his position? I always think about it, and I talk to a lot of people also very close to the Russian president. Some of them were totally opposed to his offensive into Ukraine. How does he emerge from this conflict? Is he diminished? Is he stronger now? Has he made a capital mistake? Should he have embarked on more diplomacy? Was the war inevitable? Where does Putin stand at the moment in your eyes?
Well, let me say again, without getting into the question of individuals, the Russian Federation has said as a government, take us seriously since 1992. And the United States has repeatedly said, why should we take you seriously? You're a second-rate or third-rate power. You're a gas station with nuclear weapons, whatever insult the United States wanted to throw. President Biden said in Warsaw in a speech in March 2022, that man cannot remain in power, speaking of his counterpart as the president of Russia. My God, presidents of the United States should not talk that way, period. That does not lead anywhere. Russia said, do not advance NATO to our borders. Russia said, do not leave the nuclear arms framework as the United States unilaterally did on several occasions, but most importantly, leaving the anti-ballistic missile treaty in 2002 and leaving the Intermediate Nuclear Force Treaty in 2019. And in this sense, the Russian position will be sustained in the end. NATO will not enlarge. The U.S. will return to a nuclear arms framework. And in this sense, I think Russian security is strengthened. And also, Russia's position in the world is not isolation. Russia is absolutely on normal relations with the vast majority of the world. And Europe needs to get back to diplomacy with Russia as well.
I mean, this is the next field we have to discuss, the European Union, which seems to me as a kind of epicenter of political insanity at the moment. I mean, we see whatever comes out of it, but we see some kind of silver lining of peace. At least they are talking to each other again. There is diplomacy, not only weapons, between the United States and Russia and Ukraine. And there are some, probably some hopes that this could really, you know, evolve into a peace. But in the European Union, this is my observation, they're running in the exact opposite direction. I mean, they seem now to lock themselves in their fantasies of confronting Russia, of confronting the United States. What is the matter, Jeffrey, with the European Union, this peace project, this Nobel Peace Prize winning institution, which is now on a warpath, on an eternal warpath against Russia, and it seems to have the two-front conflict also against Washington. How do you explain this? What's the matter?
Where is the Jean Monnet, the Schuman, Jacques Delors, the Romano Prodi of today? In other words, where are European politicians that have a historic perspective, that understand Europe's place in the world, that take a broad vision? They're not right now apparent. I'm sure that they exist someplace, but they're not apparent. Europe gave away its foreign policy, I say, at least since 2008, arguably decades before that. But at the Bucharest NATO summit, when the United States pushed through the statement that Ukraine and Georgia will join NATO, since that moment, there has not been a peep from Europe of a European vision. And this is very sad. What comes out of the European Commission is mostly nonsense. The rhetoric, mostly meaningless. Incidentally, it's as bad on the other side of the English Channel. I mean, what comes out of London is shockingly stupid imperial nostalgia. Britain has always been the great Russophobe of the world. That dates back to around 1840. And Starmer is absolutely as foolish as Boris Johnson, which is an amazing thing to say, by the way, because Boris Johnson was, oh my God, I don't even know where to get started. But Starmer's no better. And so we don't have, for the moment, politicians that have a historical perspective, that have a broad vision, that speak in some philosophical terms, diplomatic terms. They must exist, but we don't see them. Europe better figure this out pretty quickly, because Europe is so far below potential on everything, on its foreign policy, on its role in the world, on its economy right now, everything because of this. And Europe, you know, I'm a believer in Europe needing to be Europe, not 27 independent nations, but Europe, because Europe faces the United States, which is a challenge, even a danger to Europe. I would not preclude Donald Trump landing troops on Greenland. That sounds crazy, but I wouldn't rule it out. It sounds nuts, but believe me, it's possible. Europe faces real issues with Russia. It's not all sweetness and light, but Europe's big enough to face those issues. This is a shared continent, for heaven's sake. Europe and China, Europe and India, Europe and Africa. You need a Europe, but we don't hear anything out of Europe right now than pretty narrow-minded views.
And there are alarming developments. I don't know whether you follow the situation in Romania.
I'm not
the interior expert of Romania, but it seems to me like a coup d'état by this federal court, which just said, you know, with a strike of a pen, this election it's not valuable. The candidate is an ultra right wing extremist, Russia and Putin lover. So far, he has to be banned from any kind of political office. I mean, it's amazing, and I looked a bit in the newspapers. It's very low in the news. We don't hear anything from Brussels, but it seems totally absurd to me as a Swiss that, you know, judges can just say, you know, there has been some Russian intervention, you know, there have been some trolls or some whatever, you know, media and social media kind of manipulation. And you just say, okay, the people don't have to say anything. It's now the judges who take over. What do you make of it? How do you see this situation?
First of all, it's extraordinarily worrisome. It's obviously a repudiation of the most basic tenets of democracy. Not a peep from the rest of Europe, just crushing Romanian democracy. Why? Because the candidate that's running wants to have normal relations with Russia. But by the way, what's happening in Romania, it's a danger all over Europe because the European population saying, we don't want this war. Who's unpopular? Every single European leader that is calling for more war. They all have approval ratings of 20%. And then they have opposition parties. They call them extreme right wing. The words don't even mean something anymore. Typically, this quote, extreme right party, is for peace, not war. It's a strange language, actually. It typically means on the right, have borders, stop the mass immigration. But for peace. Often, by the way, these quote extreme right parties are actually social democratic parties in their economic policy. What makes them extreme right in many cases, without oversimplifying, is that they're anti-mass migration parties. So they want their borders protected, which incidentally is a reality in this world. If you're a rich part of the world, and the borders are open, a billion people will come to you, especially if you're a social welfare state. You know, my God, given conditions in the rest of the world, there's no end to it, that kind of economic migration. So all of this is to say the politics across Europe is the war is unpopular, and the democracy needs to be suppressed in some sense in this way by shunning parties, stopping elections, stopping candidates, limiting the debate, stopping the narrative, you know, pounding on the narrative and all the rest. It's not good. Again, I give more hope that we're going to be able to get past this phase if the United States is consequent, which not guaranteed, but if it just says, look, we're not funding this war anymore, the war will stop. When the war stops, Europe is going to have a different approach, period, because Europe can't continue this war. And maybe some cooler and saner heads are going to prevail. And that's what I'm hoping for.
And we might enter a situation when the Americans have to force the Europeans and the Germans to peace once more 80 years after the Second World War. I mean, we see it now in Germany.
Yeah,
I mean, they have just a very short remark. In Germany, they have now these coalition talks, and I looked at the programs, and at the very end, even the CDU chancellor, in which might be the chancellor at the end, he said, "We have to fight disinformation. We have to look that they are not, Russian, whatever, misinformation." I mean, these are really alarming tendencies against democracy, against free speech. Where is Europe heading to?
I'll tell you one of the most disheartening points, and we'll have to end shortly, just because of my time. The Free University of Berlin was going to host the UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine, and the Israeli ambassador called the university apparently and said, "Don't do it," and the university shut down a normal talk by a very important UN special rapporteur. In other words, don't have public discussion. This is the worst for us. Our survival, our peace, depends on discussion, on understanding, on diplomacy, not on narrative, 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 or canceling candidates. And so this is a very worrisome trend. Also in the United States, don't have any doubt about it. We have very similar risks right now. Control the narrative, you control the politics. And we can't live by narrative. We have to live by discussion, reason, diplomacy, negotiation, open debate. It's extremely important.
Let me ask you to spare your time one more question. What should the role be that Europe can play in the future? If you were a consultant to these governments, the European Union, what would you say to them? What should they try to be in the future?
I would say make Europe effective so that Europe can deal respectfully, peacefully, diplomatically, but securely vis-a-vis the United States, vis-a-vis Russia, vis-a-vis China, vis-a-vis India. I believe we are in a world of a few great powers and a lot of the world in the rest. And the major powers right now are the United States, Russia, China, and India. I want the whole world to thrive. First, Europe, it's 450 million people in the EU. It is a $20 trillion economy. It has a nuclear deterrent and the French nuclear arms. It should be a major power. But the major powers, first of all, should be at peace with each other so we don't blow up the world. That's the very first point. Second, within these powers and within Europe, there should be an economy that works. We're in a technological revolution right now. Europe doesn't have some of the big components of the new economy that it needs because the US grabs up every European company and makes it an American company. What is ASML? It's the world's leading extreme ultraviolet lithography producer of the most advanced semiconductors in the world. It's a Dutch company in principle. Who dictates all the policy of ASML? The United States. Huh? How'd that come about? Well, I know how it came about, but how does Europe let that happen? So I would like to see a Europe that can stand for peace, diplomacy, global development, prosperity, can work with other regions of the world effectively, and do so without war. That's what I would like.
One final point, we have to talk about this since you're such a prominent economist, and there is a lot of concern in our media, our business observers about these trade wars, about the tariffs. What do you say as an economist? How dangerous is this policy by the American government? What stands behind it? What does he want to achieve, the American president, with his tariffs against, whoever crosses his way?
I'll tell you a secret, complete confusion. Trump has the wrong idea, the wrong economic approach. He loves tariffs. This is ridiculous. This is only going to weaken the US economy. What the rest of the world really needs to do, honestly, is okay, try to talk America to sense. But if America cannot be talked to sense, say, okay, that's your problem. You're wrecking your own economy, but the rest of us are going to go along and continue to have open trade. This is really what the rest of the world needs to do.
Well, Jeffrey, thank you very much, Professor Sachs. Great to talk to you. I hope we can repeat this. That's so
Absolutely.
interesting what's happening, and all the best to you
We'll be in
and
touch.
continue the fantastic work.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.